This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Joe Palca, sitting in for Ira Flatow. A few years back, people in upstate New York started to notice brown bats cruising for insects in broad daylight in the middle of winter. Of course, there aren't any insects in the snows of February when the bats should be hiding out in caves, living off their fat stores until the spring. So state scientists went to check out some caves near Albany, hoping to find an explanation for these unusual winter excursions by the bats, and instead what they found was thousands of dead bats. The ones still alive were emaciated and had a mysterious white substance on their noses. The next year, these die-offs had spread to caves in Pennsylvania, Vermont, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, and scientists aren't sure how or why. But my next guest has been doing some detective work in the lab trying to figure out what's killing off these bats, and let me introduce him. His name is David Blehert. He's the head of the Diagnostic Microbiology. At the United States Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin. And he joins us on the phone today from Wisconsin. Welcome to the program, Dr. Blehert.
Thanks very much, Joe. Happy to be here.
And if you want to join the conversation, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about what we're talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to the topic. So, just recently, there's a paper by you and some colleagues in Science Magazine that looks at this white substance and maybe has identified it. So what is the white substance that they found on the bat's nose?
Right. So what we found is a fungus that belongs to the genus Geomyces, which is actually a common soil fungus around the world involved in the decay of organic matter. The one that we've isolated from bats, we believe, has some unique properties that may have allowed it to emerge as a new pathogenic threat to bats in the Northeast.
So, well, first of all, would people have noticed this if it had been occurring on bats before, or is this something that they're sure that this is a unique experience for bats to be infected with this fungus?
I think that we can be fairly certain that this is a unique thing among bats. So, for example, there is a species of federally listed endangered bats, the Indiana myotis, or the Indiana bat. And so Indiana bats, for example, in New York State, their hibernation caves are surveyed every other year, and literally every single bat they find in the caves is photographed and counted.
Uh-huh.
So people are out there monitoring.
So this would have been noticed it would have been picked up if it had occurred before. So that suggests that it's related, but I guess the question is, is this a cause or an effect of the bats, whatever's doing in the bats?
Right, and that still does remain somewhat of a question. We have our hypotheses on this, and some of us favor some over others.
Well, what would be the mechanism that a fungus on a bat's nose would be lethal?
Right. So first of all, it's much more extensive than just the bat's nose.
Uh-huh.
That's perhaps the most visible manifestation, which led to the name for the disease, white nose syndrome. But we also do find the fungus growing on other exposed skin surfaces, such as the ear pinna, and then perhaps most importantly, the wings, which...
Mm-hmm.
Wings are critical for flight, and flight is critical for feeding. So severe damage to the wings, if it affects the ability of the bats to fly through scarring or holes that the fungal infection puts in the wings. The bat emerges from hibernation, this could then impact its ability to effectively feed.
Uh-huh. So this may be a problem that's actually occurring during the warmer months, but they're experiencing the problem during the cold months, and they're forced to go out and try and feed some more.
Well, actually, so we have actually characterized this disease as a disease of hibernation.
Uh-huh.
So one of the properties of the fungus is that it's what we call a psychrophile, or a cold-loving fungus. So it selectively only grows at cold temperatures, and these are temperatures that are fully consistent with the year-round temperatures of the bat hibernation caves, which is about the same as the temperature within your refrigerator. So once the bats survive fungal infection and emerge in the spring, They warm up their body temperatures by activating their metabolism. They move to warmer environments. I don't think that those warmer temperatures would kill the fungus, but it can't actively grow at those temperatures. So effectively, during the summer, I believe that the bats are capable of still spreading the fungus among each other, but they do have this opportunity potentially to mount some recovery to the damage done during hibernation.
Okay. Well, let's take a call now from one of our listeners. And again, the number is 800-989-8255. Let's go to Ron in Amherst, New Hampshire. Ron, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks. I was wondering, I know there's been an outbreak of rabies in different animals, raccoons, and I know out in Michigan, bats and rabies are a big problem. If rabies could be involved in this, you know, I know rabies can cause unusual behavior in animals and things like that. Like you said, you didn't know if the fungus was the cause or the effect. You know, maybe could rabies be involved?
Interesting question. What about that?
Right. So we actually, I think, can fairly confidently say that rabies is not involved. Rabies does exist at low incidence among insectivorous bats or insect-feeding bats like we would find in the northeastern U.S. But as a matter of fact, virtually all of these animals that have come through the laboratory have been tested for rabies, and they've all been negative. Something else worth noting is one of the initial observations that something was wrong in the population is bats that get tested for rabies are generally bats that are aberrantly behaving, as a manifestation of some of the neurological effects of the rabies virus infection. And what was noticed at the New York State Department of Health, where rabies testing is done, was that their rabies infections of little brown bats, the primary species infected by the fungus, spiked to about 10 times the 25-year average for the winter months. So really, there should be no bats coming through the rabies lab in the winter because the bats are all hibernating away in their caves. But with bats flying around and dying on the winter landscape, a lot of those animals were being submitted for rabies testing.
Interesting.
And once again, they were all negative.
Interesting. Okay. Well, we'll have to look for another explanation. Let's go to another call now and go to Paul in Provo, Utah. Paul, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you. This is really intriguing. It was mentioned that the bats were found dying in one place, I think it was Albany, and then they were found with the same malady in another geographic area nearby, and it makes me wonder if you have tried to trace this fungus through insects whose larvae emerge from the ground or various terrestrial sources, and that maybe they are transmitting or transferring this fungus from one geographic area to another based upon natural migrations or wind patterns or something like that, rather than it being contagious from bat to bat.
Interesting, Paul. What do you think about that, David Bleart?
I actually think that's a good idea, and potentially we could look at some of the newly introduced invasive insect species to the region, such as introduced gypsy moths, for example. So that is something we've talked about. And if it does turn out to be a primarily pathogenic fungus that was introduced, there's many means by which it could have introduced, you know, starting with humans, ranging to some animal species, to an insect species, even to wind-borne dust.
Interesting. We have a question from somebody called Canis Looming on Second Life who says, is there an emerging infectious disease? Is this an emerging infectious disease that might be applicable to other mammals? Is this an opportunistic infection that's grabbing bats selectively, or could it be other mammals?
Right. Well, once again, one of the important properties to consider here is that this fungus cannot grow above about 65 degrees Fahrenheit. So humans and most other warm-blooded mammals, for example, have an internal body temperature and even a very warm skin temperature, somewhere around 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. So right now I would consider it a potential concern for hibernating animals that drop their core body or skin surface temperatures down to below 70 degrees Fahrenheit, even in the 40-degree Fahrenheit range where this fungus grows optimally.
Yeah.
I don't think it poses a threat to humans.
No. From what you describe, it doesn't sound like it would. Okay, let's try another call now and go to Daniel in Denver, Colorado. Daniel, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thanks. First of all, I'm not a scientist, but I'm just trying to apply a little bit of common sense out here. Here in Colorado, we have a pine beetle killing out millions of pine trees because of what is believed to be a direct result of global warming, where the pine beetle is actually surviving higher temperatures than normal in winter times, so that allows to attack and kill the trees out here, or pines in this particular point. The first question is, why is this fungus able to attack these bats, and what was different before that wasn't able to attack them?
Yeah.
The first question. The second one is, could there be a relationship between higher temperatures because due to global warming? And the worst-case scenario is, what happens if the entire population of bats, I doubt that this is going to happen, but if it does, if they do get wiped out, what would the direct impact be on humans?
Okay, Daniel, I'll have to let I'll have to get David Blehart to answer that quickly because we're almost out of time for this segment. But global warming causing this infection, or why now, I guess, are the two big questions.
Right. So why now? So first of all, we do have to consider that perhaps this fungus was recently introduced. And if so, that's why now. It's a new introduced pathogen that's just emerged as a problem. Alternatively, there could be some environmental perturbation that in the Northeast region that has allowed a fungus that was always present in the environment to emerge as an opportunistic pathogen. With regard to global climate change, that's certainly something we all consider. I need to emphasize, we don't have any data to indicate such, but if we really want to go out on a limb and speculate, Geomyces fungi have been discovered in Antarctica, associated, for example, with Antarctic birds called skuas. One could go out on a limb and hypothesize that, if you want to get science fiction on this, that maybe this is something that was once locked in Arctic permafrost, and with a decrease of Arctic permafrost was liberated and, perhaps then brought southward through animal migration.
Well, as you say, it's an interesting speculation, but we'll have to leave it there because we're out of time. Thank you, David Blehart. He's the head of the Diagnostic Microbiology at the United States Geological Survey in Madison, Wisconsin. Stay with us. We have more to talk about on bats when we come back after this break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. Later in the hour, a new exhibition at the intersection of science and beauty. But first, it's Halloween, and we're going to talk about a creature that has fangs, drinks blood, and comes out only at night. And that is the aptly named creature, the vampire bat. Vampire bats live in the tropics of Central and South America. They scour the night for unsuspecting prey like chickens and cows, slice the skin or hide of their prey with razor-sharp teeth, and gently lick the wound, collecting the draining stream of blood with their mouths. And my next guest has raised these delicate bloodletters. He joins me now to talk about them and other creatures that are happy to drink your blood. Bill Shutt is the author of the new book, Dark Banquet, Blood and the Curious Lives of Blood-Feeding Creatures. He's also an associate professor of biology at the C.W. Post College of Long Island University, and he's also a research associate in mammalogy at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He joins us on the phone from Connecticut today. Welcome to the program, Dr. Shutt.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, so, first of all, what, I'm curious, drew you to the study of vampire bats in the first place?
Well, I guess I've always been into strange animals. When I was a kid, I was the kid who had a monkey and a boa constrictor and all sorts of weird critters. So, 30 years later, when people contact me for the first time in a long time, and they find out that I spent a lot of time studying vampire bats as part of my career, they're not surprised.
They go, it figures. That was
exactly.
What else would you expect from young Bill Shutt? Oh, I should remind people that our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And if you want to talk with Bill Shutt about vampire bats or several of the other interesting blood-sucking, I guess we think of it as sucking, but actually they I guess it drips into them. Although you describe these interesting capillary tubes that sort of help extract the blood. My question is, you make the point in the book, and I thought it's very interesting, that blood is not the world's most nutritious substance. You have to have a specialized digestive system to get a satisfactory meal out of it.
Yeah, not only a specialized digestive system, but basically your entire physiology needs to be highly evolved in order to deal with the fact that blood, for instance, doesn't have any fat in it. So you can't store fat, which means that you have to feed on blood every day. Mm-hmm. And that presents some major problems.
So such as?
You can't hibernate.
Uh-huh. So vampire bats don't hibernate. That's why they're in the tropics, I presume.
Excuse me?
I say vampire bats don't hibernate, so they're in the tropics, unlike the brown bats that we were just hearing about in New York State.
Yes, this is the reason why you're never going to find them in the United States, because the bats around here run out of insects during the fall and winter, and so they get by hibernating. Vampire bats would never be able to do that.
I guess you also have to have pretty sophisticated kidneys or blood, water balance mechanisms, because blood's mostly water anyway.
Exactly. They have to get rid of high amounts of water. So while they're feeding, they're actually urinating. And then it becomes a problem of conserving water at a certain point, so their kidneys kick into a second gear that turns into more of a water conservation device. So any of the anatomical systems that you look at in a vampire bat, digestive system, their reproductive system, so anything you can think of, is really neat to study from an anatomical point of view.
Right. So have you ever been bitten by a vampire bat?
No.
Are there reports of them biting humans?
Oh, yeah. I mean, nowadays these are generally really poor people who are living in areas where, for example, you don't have screens or doors. But if you're out camping in the middle of an area where vampire bats exist and you're not using mosquito nets, then you can get bitten. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. Primarily, vampire bats are feeding on livestock and other animals.
I see. But I guess what I'm curious about is the bite of a vampire bat painful? I mean, would you know that you've been bitten by, or is it one of these, the teeth are so sharp and the wound is so small that it wouldn't bother you?
Well, if you were handling a vampire bat and got bit, you would know about it in a hurry because, with the animal struggling and frightened, it could put a real hurt on you and put a serious bite onto you. If it's sneaking up and trying to feed, that's a completely different matter. And most likely, if you were asleep, you would never know that you'd been bitten because their teeth are so sharp that they generally make a painless bite when they do bite when they're looking for food.
All right, interesting. That's what I suspected because you described some of these animals that they sort of nuzzle up to, these chickens, and trick the chicken into thinking their young is coming along, and then take a little snack.
Yeah, that's the white-winged vampire bat, and we saw that behavior with a colony that I was keeping at Cornell University when I was a graduate student there. The bats approached the birds. We thought the bird was going to peck at the bats, and suddenly the bat went underneath the breast of the bird and sort of snuggled into this region where the chicks usually go to warm themselves, and the bird just kind of hunkered down and fell asleep. And meanwhile, we saw this a couple of minutes later. We see this trail of blood coming out from underneath the bird. The bat was feeding underneath this hen.
Clever bat.
Yeah.
All right.
Great stuff.
Let's take a call now. And remember, our number is 800-989-8255. Let's go to Gail in San Antonio, Texas. Gail, welcome to Science Friday.
Welcome. Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. A friend of mine, I have an interest in entomology, insects, and so a friend of mine told me about this new moth that they had found would actually drink blood. And I got to watch a bit of the video on the Internet where it was showing, you know, sticking its probe into a finger and another part was, you know, on the person's face, and it was actually drinking the blood. And I didn't get to watch the whole program, so I was hoping that he could tell us a little bit more about that if he knew.
Bloodthirsty moths.
I think that moth lives in Southeast Asia, if I'm wrong, and it's really one of the creatures that I wanted to study but didn't get a chance to. So I do know that not a whole lot is known about its behavior, except that it's got this curious diet. And do you remember if this was an Asian species?
It was, and I remember that the person studying it was female, but Yeah, she was in Southeast Asia.
But this is also blood gathered opportunistically, or do they have a sharp enough proboscis to...
They had a sharp enough proboscis, and they would stick it. They showed it drilling into the person's finger, and then another time they showed it where it was, like, hovering on a man's lip and sticking it into the softer lip. But they still were able to get it even from the finger. It was quite unique to what I would think of as how a moth could feed.
Yeah, that's wild. I know there are some moths that have sharpened proboscis that, that they'll use to drill into fruit, but this has probably been this behavior hasn't been known for very long, and I imagine that there are going to be some people looking into this to see if there are other blood-feeding adaptations there, like an anticoagulant.
Right.
Sounds like a fascinating animal, and,
yeah.
And from the little that I know, it seems that... No, it's a creature that is in need of study.
Yeah, well, Bill, we might have to get a ruling from NPR librarian Kim Molesky on whether it's proboscis or proboscises. But anyway, Gail, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
Okay, let's take another call now and go to Adam in Anchorage, Alaska. Adam, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, I had a question about... the vampire bats and other blood-sucking creatures, do they sometimes receive diseases from the creature that they're sucking on and have those infect the bat or other blood-suckers?
Interesting.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I get this question a lot about vampire bats, and sometimes I hear it, would these creatures, could they transmit AIDS? While blood-feeding creatures are known to transmit different bacteria and disease-causing agents, there's never been, I don't believe there's ever been a study that showed that blood taken in from a vampire bat or a blood-feeding creature that was diseased blood, that disease could then be transmitted to a second host or a second victim. These relationships between pathogenic organisms and the creatures that carry them are very complex, and they are highly evolved, and they've taken a long time to develop. And so it's not saying that couldn't happen. It's just saying that at this point that I know of, there are no instances of where for example, if somebody had malaria and you had a bat withdraw blood from somebody and then bite someone else, you could transmit malaria.
No, I don't. I think there's the malaria parasite has an interesting life cycle, and part of it depends on whatever the environment is inside a mosquito gut.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's going to be actually. While we were talking, our crack editorial staff has found the link to this. To this moth, this Asian moth that drinks blood, and we'll get that up on our website sometime in the not-too-distant future. So check back, and you can find out exactly about this moth. What you started with vampire bats, and that's obviously your research interest, but what got you into this book of other blood-sucking animals? Again, is it your childhood love of the macabre, or is it was there some other idea to understand better the evolution of blood drinking as an evolutionary process?
Well, that was all part of it. I think one of the things that was a real stimulus to getting me started on this book was when I learned that there were these that creatures that were as different as vampire bats and leeches and ticks and bedbugs all shared these common adaptations that had evolved convergently, had evolved separately, and so you've got these, all of them share sharpened teeth and stealthy approach, and they're all real small. If you're going to feed on blood, you're going to have to do it quite often for the most part, and if you need to feed on a lot of blood, that's just going to make it more difficult. So those connections that I saw between very, very different animals, that was one of the things that got me interested in telling the stories of some of these other blood feeders besides vampires, things like leeches and bedbugs. And the fact that there is so much news today built around animals like ticks and bedbugs are having this unbelievable resurgence. So once I started to delve into the things that I didn't know a great deal about, the learning curve was really steep. It got interesting in a hurry. I just met these wonderful people. You could not write, if you were writing fiction, you couldn't come up with some of these folks.
Yeah.
So the book just took off from there.
That's an excellent story. I have to tell you, by the way, we all are, well, you, according to the paragon of literary virtue or grammatical usage and language here at NPR, Kim Malesky, she tells me in an email that it's proboscises or proboscises. She's not clear whether the C is hard or soft, but maybe I'll get another email before the show's
over.
Well,
I stand corrected, and see, you'll learn something.
Isn't it great? That's just what we try to do here at National Public Radio. We give you something new to learn every day.
Well, thanks.
But right now, we're talking about blood and blood animals with Bill Shutt. He's the author of a new book called Dark Banquet, Blood and the Curious Lives of Blood-Feeding Creatures. I'm Joe Palca, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Okay, let's see if we can find another call now. And how about let's talk to Michael in Cape Coral, Florida. Michael, you're in a swing state. What's on your mind?
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great.
I've been in pest control for about 14 years. I know there's a beetle in South America. I don't know the name of it, unfortunately. I've lost the name of it. But I know it feeds on blood on your face, and it's not the bite that's actually dangerous, but it leaves droppings on your face.
Yeah, leishmaniasis.
If you rub that into your face, until recently, the only cure was a heart transplant.
Right.
Yeah.
That would be the assassin bug, red viad. It's not actually a beetle. It's a card-carrying bug. And they're one of the creatures that we think that might be one of the reasons that Charles Darwin had a lifelong chronic illnesses when he returned from his voyage around the world, because he had gotten bit by red viads when he was in, I believe, Bolivia or Ecuador.
Really? Now, is that the same as Chagas disease? I thought that was called the kissing beetle, and that was transmitted by a beetle.
Yeah. I'm not positive what the distinction is there, but there's probably more than one.
Yeah.
But the feces, to me, sounds like the assassin bug.
Yeah, could be. Interesting point. All right, let's try another call now and go to, how about Jamie in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Jamie, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hey, Jamie.
How are you?
Great.
I overheard that you guys were studying, this gentleman is studying the blood-sucking bats in South America. And I'm from Chile, Sudamerica, and I was studying that over there in South America, they also have the chupacabra, which means the blood-sucking goat.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if there's any possibility that there's been some kind of a cross hybrid with a goat, a dog, and a bat somehow, because that's what these pictures look like of this strange phenomenon over there.
Wow, Jamie.
I thought I'd ask you.
Yeah, well, for Halloween, it's a completely fair question. Jamie, thanks for the call. What about that, Phil Shutt?
Yeah, I think chupacabra means goat sucker, and that the implication there is that goats have been bled dry and killed. I've never heard before that chupacabras are some type of a mutant bat goat creature.
Yeah.
It's a new one for me.
So I wanted you to talk a little bit before I let you go about the bed bugs. What's the deal with them? They do eat blood as well, and largely our blood.
Yeah. There's been a wild resurgence of these creatures. They're very well adapted to the way to all of our habits, clutter and travel and they're very, very difficult to get rid of once you've got an infestation. I could run down. There's a menu of things that we do that just make it very easy for them to get into our houses. If you pick up furniture on the side of the curb and bring it in, these creatures may have may be infesting that nice looking bookshelf. Or if you have people come over to your house to come to a party, where do you have them throw their coats when they come in?
Right. And what do they cause problems, or are they just annoying?
They're just, well, I think it just freaks people out that you're lying in bed and you're getting bitten by these things. But there are no reports of any type of disease transmitted by them, luckily.
Okay. All right. Well, Bill Shutt, we'll leave it there. I like the idea of not letting the bed bugs bite. What was the Latin name? I forget now.
Cymex lectolurius.
Yeah, don't let the Cymex lectolurius bite you. Anyway, thanks very much for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bill Shutt is the author of the new book, Dark Banquet, Blood and the Curious Lives of Blood-Feeding Creatures. He's also an associate professor of biology at the C.W. Post College of Long Island University, and he's a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. When we come back, we'll be talking about the intersection of science and beauty and books that exhibit both. So stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. A brief program note, they live in both real and virtual worlds. They post their new baby's pics on Facebook. They blog, vlog, and chronicle their daily lives digitally. Their Generation Net. Join Neil Conan and Don Tapscott on his new book, Grown Up Digital, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. But for now, we're talking about science and beauty. In 1609, Galileo built a new optical device, a tube with lenses. His telescope was pretty weak compared to the ones we use to gaze at the heavens today, but he turned it on the moon and was startled to see its lumpy, cratered surface, far different from the smooth and perfect sphere famous scholars and philosophers had described. Soon afterwards, he turned his telescope toward Jupiter and discovered four moons orbiting the giant planet. He made dozens of drawings of his observations and published them in 1610 in a book called The Starry Messenger. You can take a look at one of these original volumes of Galileo's observations and even peer through a replica of his telescope at a new exhibition called Beautiful Science, Ideas That Changed the World. It opens this weekend at California's Huntington Library, that's in Pasadena, and it highlights the arc of scientific research through the centuries. My next guest has spent several years delving into these beautiful stories of science from Galileo's time to today. Let me introduce him now. Daniel Lewis is the Dibner Senior Curator of History of Science and Technology at the Huntington Library in San Marino, which is right next to Pasadena, California. He joins us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena. Dan Lewis, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Joe. Happy Halloween.
Thank you. I wonder if they're out in force in Pasadena now, but we'll talk about that later. let's start by asking the question, this notion, beautiful science, what are you trying to capture in this exhibition?
Well, one of the things that this does is sort of crook a seductive finger towards an unwitting public, because talking about science and talking about history has the potential to be a doubly eye glaze over topic for for a visiting public, and I know that science is beautiful and muscular and delicate, and it's beautiful in different ways. And so, to talk about beauty is to talk about a number of specific things, but it's also a chance to talk about different kinds of beauty, because there's certainly not one certain stripe of beauty, and at times it is like a delicate clock. At times it's a very robust, burly sort of thing. And some of these works in the exhibit, as I assembled this over the last couple of years, if you look at them visually, they're really spectacularly uninteresting in textual form. And I'm trying to break away from library exhibits, at least, where you find yourself staring into a case, looking at something like Charles Darwin's Origin of Species, which is 502 pages long and has but a single illustration in all that text, and it's a chart in the illustration. So there's a beautiful idea behind that relatively uninteresting visual object that is of vital and giant importance. Other works are really spectacular visually. They range from the beautiful and gory in the medical domain to the first illustrations of the moon under magnification by Galileo, as you mentioned. So it spans a wide spectrum.
It's as you know, I've seen some of the pieces in the exhibit, and they are mesmerizing. I'd like to ask our listeners if they would like to join the conversation to please give us a call. The number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. I guess I should say this exhibit's going to be around for a while, so it's not like you have to run out and see it tomorrow.
It's a permanent exhibit, and permanent exhibits are challenging for all institutions, whether it's a museum or a library. That's because light is the enemy of artwork and paper and ink, and so we actually have conservators come in to do a page change anywhere from 12 weeks to 6 months for a work. So there's a lot of activity making sure that things aren't damaged by the materials. And just as scientists are stewards of historical ideas over the centuries, curators in libraries are also stewards of material that really is just passing through their hands that they really hope will be preserved for future generations. So there's really a long-term stewardship notion to physical protection of the material in library exhibits.
So we've talked some about the Galileo Starry Messenger. What are some of the other greatest hits of the kinds of volumes and pictures that they'll be able to see in the exhibit?
Well, we have so many things, Joe. We've got Isaac Newton's own copy.
We've only
of the
got about 15 more minutes. So
this is my challenge.
Yeah.
Exhibits always take up a tiny fraction of a percent of a library's holdings. Library exhibits do, and so it's challenging to find things that tell a story and are high spots as well. But we've got Isaac Newton's own copy of the Principia Mathematica, his great work on the structure of the laws of the universe, and it has annotations in his own hand. It's not the only copy. Newton had other copies. He annotated more extensively, but we certainly have that one. We've also got Newton's own copy of the Optics, which was his great work on optics, in another section of the gallery, which is in four parts: astronomy, natural history, medicine, and then light and optics. We've got stars, superstars in every one of the sections. We've got Robert Hooke's Micrographia in the natural history section, accompanied by a facsimile of a microscope where you can look at a flea. Pulgens irritans is the flea that Hooke drew and that is represented there. And I've been trying to find a 17th century flea to show on the slide for this microscope to go with the 17th century illustrations on the book. So there's Robert Hooke. There are a whole bevy of beautiful medical works. Robert Hunter's book on the gravid uterus, the state of the body during pregnancy. A fabulous book by a Frenchman named Gautier Dagoty with these beautiful mezzotints from the 18th century in color. Very, very rare and very labor-intensive process. So these works span a bunch of different types of artistry as well as a bunch of different topics and different ideas that work their way along through this notion of beautiful science.
Okay, let's take a call now and go to Andrew in Philadelphia. Andrew, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, I love the show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to make the observation that I've lately fallen in love with astrolabes, Islamic ones in particular from, I think, the 12th century. I saw some in the Smithsonian, and I've seen some photographs and books, and I think they're, you know, just spectacular artistically.
Okay, that's interesting. And Dan Lewis, are you familiar with these Islamic works?
Astrolabes are wonderful, and they stem out of an Islamic tradition. And one of the things that came along with this collection that evolved into this exhibit is something called the Burndy Library, which was based at MIT for many years. And in the Burndy Library were a series of objects that are based on astronomical observation, either for direct observation or as didactic teaching tools. So along with astrolabes, I don't have any astrolabes in the exhibit because they're often big, not always, and there were very few in the Burndy collection. But I've got spectacular sundials, which date back to the 16th century. And I've got what's called an armillary sphere, and the one we have is one that's been in the Huntington's collections for many decades. It dates to about 1550. And they're bands of strips of wood that serve as a model for rotating the heavens around, in this case, the Earth, which proved to be incorrect because the heavens don't rotate around the Earth. But it's a way to – they're really beautiful visually, and they let you perform operations and move things around. But astronomers also use really big instruments. So Tycho Brahe, the Swedish astronomer based in the island of Hvin, had these gigantic tools he used for naked-eye astronomy, something called the Mural Quadrant. I've got a great big work, an atlas by Johann Blau, showing one of these Mural Quadrants of Tycho Brahe's. And so the tools of astronomy were really spectacular. One of the greatest works in the history of astronomy is something called the Astronomicum Caesarium by Petrus Oppianus, printed in 1540 in Ingolstadt. And it, Owen Gingrich, who's a well-known historian of science and an astronomer at Harvard, has called this the most beautiful scientific book ever printed. And I'm not, that's a hard superlative to use in a field rich with goodies, but it really is spectacular. And it makes use of these rotating paper discs or volvelles to perform astronomical calculations. They were very accurate, to within perhaps a minute of arc in some cases. And it's lavishly printed and lavishly colored and done as an homage to a king. And it's not often if ever, seen on exhibit. So that's up in the astronomy section of the exhibit.
We're talking with Daniel Lewis about his new exhibit, or the new exhibit, but I guess you can call it his, at the Huntington Library that shows science, or beautiful science. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go now to James in Cincinnati, Ohio. James, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, with this exhibit included with maybe the ancient, like Incan and Mayan stuff, where they were able to predict the movement of the stars and moons and stuff with great precision, and all the artifacts from that, and also from Egypt and those types of areas, like before Common Era.
Okay, interesting.
I'll take my answer off.
Okay, great. Thanks, James.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Daniel Lewis, prehistoric,
That's a field called archaeoastronomy, and it's widely represented and talked about. The exhibits always emerge out of the contents of an institution's collections, and so a lot of this archaeoastronomy isn't stuff that is easily collectible in paper form. So if it's on a gigantic piece of stone sitting in a Mayan village, it's hard to work into the exhibit. There's a bit of that. This exhibit tends to privilege Anglo-American astronomy and to some degree Islamic astronomy, which is another grand traditional source of astronomical discovery and knowledge. So a lot of the archaeoastronomy doesn't show up in this exhibit. It's not placed well as a material type for an exhibit. It's hard to show, as I said, some of these really gigantic things. If I had more space, I could have expanded into a newer, a really, really comprehensive set of things. So this has a particular focus. It doesn't include the archaeoastronomy details.
Okay, interesting. Let's take another call now from Mary in Louisville, Kentucky. Mary, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for taking my call. I really enjoy the program. I'd like to ask if you have had a particular focus on how women have contributed to science. I know that probably there's a publication bias in the ancient times toward that, but I was curious if you had noticed that at all, or if you tried to find manuscripts and et cetera.
Interesting.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Dan Lewis, women.
There's a great tradition of women in the history of science in every domain, and even though it tended to be men as a rule working in science, women made many vitally important discoveries and observations, and I've got a number of works in there that really speak to that. A woman named Maria Sibylla Marion did a spectacular volume on the insects of Suriname that I've got up in the exhibit and in digital form as well, so you can turn the pages of this spectacular work. A very brave pioneer who went to Suriname with her daughter and collected and drew for quite some time these insects and plants of Suriname. Annie Jump Cannon, a 20th century astronomer at Mount Wilson who classified stars by the tens of thousands, writes a great letter about how she hates to go on vacation because she's leaving behind her star catalog and wishes she could keep working on it. Caroline Herschel, one of the great Herschel family of astronomers, has observational work that's mentioned and covered in the show. There's also a section in the medicine subsection on childbirth, which is a particular strength of the Huntington's collections, but is also obviously a female topic. And midwives, for many centuries, were the ones who facilitated birth and knew the most about the birthing process. We have a really, really rare ivory model of it's an obstetrics model from about 1550 with removable parts. So this ivory model is a woman laying there, and you can remove the belly and then remove the viscera and kind of work your way down to the little fetus inside as a teaching tool. So,
Very interesting.
The childbirth section is something that speaks to women's issues.
Excellent, excellent. We're talking with Dan Lewis about a new exhibit at the Huntington Library. I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take another call now. This time we'll go to Paul in Portland, Oregon. Paul, welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, I'm just curious as to whether you know about Adam Elsheimer's painting of the night sky. It was done in Rome in 1609, and it includes the details of Galileo's sky.
Wow.
I always thought, they must have known each other. He was an extremely detailed and slow painter. And I actually have a print that was done in 1611 of this painting, and it just seems extraordinary. I've never found any actual historical connection between the two, but they had to know each other.
Well, possibly, but you say Elsheimer is the name.
Yes, Adam Elsheimer.
Okay, Dan Lewis.
I must confess, I haven't heard of Adam Elsheimer. The telescope came along in about 1608, and was patented simultaneously by three different people. So Galileo wasn't the first to use a telescope, certainly, and he was the first to produce a printed work, but I have not heard of this mural. I'd be really curious to hear more about that. That's a really interesting fact.
The painting itself is in a museum in Germany, and I've been fascinated by it by a long time, because I just think they had to know each other, because it's an amazing, the first truly amazing painting of the night sky. Very detailed and very accurate.
Paul, thanks very much for that. You know, it doesn't surprise me, actually, that artists unconnected specifically with science have been drawn into science, because when we were looking into flooding issues in Venice, for example, in Italy, some of the famous paintings from the Venetian school showed buildings that are still around today, and you can see where the water line was. So you get some information from the painting that way.
There are all sorts of clues in the visual record about many different things. Speaking of evidence in books and manuscripts, one of the things that is that Isaac Newton did with his own books was he would actually dog-ear the pages of the book to point to a particular passage. So if there was a paragraph in there he wanted to highlight, he'd dog-ear the page up from the corner or down from the corner, so it pointed to it. And that's behavior we don't usually prohibit, don't allow in our reading room. And so I'm going to have these books in the Burundi Library that go out with dog ears. But they're really direct physical evidence, that sort of thing, like the water line in a painting, shows, you know, how there's a life to these things. And it's one of the things I love about old books and manuscripts is there's a life to them. They have stains and fingerprints and marginalia written in the margins of books. And the subtitle of this exhibit is It's Beautiful Science, Ideas That Changed the World. And that's my stand-in for saying history, which is a word that's nowhere in the exhibit, because of the fact that these things are a continuum over a long period of time, from the distant past up to the present and then on into the future.
All right, we'll have to leave it there, Dan. Thanks for that lovely thought at the end. Dan Lewis is the Dibner Senior Curator of History of Science and Technology at the Huntington Library in San Marino. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for joining me today. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had outstanding help from NPR librarian Key Molesky. If you have comments or questions, write to us. The address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. Ira Flatow will be back next week for NPR News in Washington. I'm Joe Palca.